Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Fires across the Los Angeles areas have killed at least 25 people, destroyed more than 12,000 structures, and charred more than 60 square miles. The strongest winds have weakened, giving firefighters a much-needed break, but the National Weather Service says dangerous conditions are expected back again next week. Tens of thousands of people in Los Angeles County remain under evacuation orders. There's already been plenty of finger-pointing and blame-casting, but anyone who knows anything about wildfires will tell you that this was an impossible situation. No firefighting agency, no matter how well-prepared, could have stopped this from happening. But we do need to talk about and ask some big questions about how to keep this from happening again and again. Lazo Gichos writes about that in The Nation. His article is, "It's Time to Rethink Everything About How We Fight Fires." And Lazo, welcome to The Source.
David, thank you for having me.
So what do you see happening in California? You have been on the fire line yourself, so talk about that.
I have. I've worked as a wildland firefighter on an engine crew in Washington, Oregon. And what's happening in California, like you said, the situation in L.A., is impossible for firefighters on the ground. This is not an agency level failure or a failure of certain leaders or of certain crews. This is a policy failure that's more than 100 years in the making. And, you know, as you said, as the director of FEMA's US Fire Administration said, we can't buy our way out of this. We can't get out of this catastrophe with more spending on fire suppression. So what's happening is the effect of a lot of compounding issues that have built up over decades and centuries, and they're coming to a head right now.
Our phone lines are open. If you've got a question or a comment about the firefighting situation in California, what we need to be doing differently. And we have these conditions here in Texas. So this isn't just a California situation. It's just a matter of time. And it's been about a year since we had the Smokehouse Creek fires here in Texas, which was the largest wildfire in the state's history. So, yeah, this happens in Texas as well. But our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Call in. Let us know what you think. So, Alazo, just that point there. Do you think people are going to be walking away from this experience and saying this is a California problem? We don't need to worry about that in Texas.
Well, like you said, you know, yourself, people in Texas are already worrying about this. When we have these issues that are so exacerbated in California by things like specific weather conditions with the Santa Ana winds, we're looking at maybe an amplified version, but, you know, very similar things to this firestorm in California happened in Boulder and in Lahaina in the last couple of years.
Hawaii.
Where whole communities were destroyed. Right, in Hawaii. Whole communities were destroyed. People were killed. And it was a result of this convergence of overstocked fuel, climate change driven drought and wind conditions, and housing development that doesn't consider vulnerability.
Well, so let's talk about climate change a bit. I'm sure it's going to be a central point to what we're going to be talking about. But first off, so right. Some people say calling it climate change is really not descriptive enough, that we should be talking about climate variation or climate extremes. Because what happens in California, and it's also happened here in Texas, is that we have more bouts of wet weather, and then we have longer periods of drought. So the wet weather allows the vegetation to grow, and then the drought dries it out and leaves it there and creates the fuel for the fires to sweep through and be very difficult to put out. So should we be thinking about it in those terms?
I'm glad you bring that up. That's actually a great point. And we saw that in Washington and Oregon, where I was fighting fire last summer, where, like you said, increased moisture, increased variance in seasonal conditions. And, you know, to me, climate change means that increase in variability, but it is definitely more descriptive to talk about an increase in variance, a decrease in stability. And I think that decrease in stability in long-term conditions is a central theme to this too.
California was well prepared for this. They've had these massive wildfires before. They have institutions like Cal Fire, the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. They have forecasting on the ground that it's the most advanced in the world for firefighting. You know, helicopters, drones. They're always trying to prepare for this. But even then, of course, we have to look at, this is not firefighting season, is it?
Right. And there was some issue in the beginning of the Palisades fire and the Eaton fire with requisitioning resources. But I think broader than that, it's important to look at different scales of preparedness. So on the day that fire started, on just a few days ago, California was, for all intents and purposes, very well prepared. Los Angeles was very well prepared to suppress a fire. But being prepared for suppression this week or tomorrow or in a month is very different from being prepared for what might happen to the ecosystem that we're all a part of. And I'll come back to that later. But when we talk about preparedness for fire, we're often talking about what would happen, how well would we be situated if a fire were to break out tomorrow? And we talk about this in firefighting too, where certain communities are better prepared because they've done work in the past months or years to clean up overstocked fuel, to create fire breaks, to put infrastructure in place. And that's all sort of one day preparedness. But when we look at what's been happening in those ecosystems, especially in Southern California, but everywhere in a lot of the Western United States and Texas, it's a century or more of setup that has brought us to these conditions. And that includes climate change, that includes invasive species that are more flammable, overstocked fuel, development of housing. And so those all compound to make us, even if we're prepared with firefighting crews or equipment or aircraft in the short term, those factors combine to make us unprepared in the medium and long term.
So, your article is, it's time to rethink everything about how we fight fires. But it sounds like you're saying we need to rethink everything that we think or we say about fires. I mean, if we're starting to fight these fires, then it's already too late. We need to be thinking about them before there is a point of ignition. And I've got to hit this break, but when we come, I want to talk more about that. And, California, our most populous state in the union, how do you deal with the fact that, that's where people want to live? We're going to talk about that. Our phone lines are open. If you got a question or a comment about what you've seen in these horrific fires in California, do you wonder if that could happen here? Let me tell you, yes, it could. So what do we need to be doing locally to prepare and to prevent that? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this.
The City of San Antonio Revitalize SA Corridor Leadership Program offers no-cost training for those interested in neighborhood commercial corridor revitalization. Over 9 months, participants will obtain leadership and strategy skills and have an opportunity for grant funding. Applications at sanantonio.gov/edd/revitalizeSA. This nonprofit message is underwritten by the Economic Development Department.
Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a conversation with Laszlo Gichos. He has written an article in The Nation magazine. It's time to rethink everything about how we fight fires, looking at what's going on in the L.A. area right now. And also, we need to adopt that here in Texas as well. We have in the Hill Country exploding growth, a lot of homes being built in places where if there was a wildfire, firefighters could not access those areas. It'd be very difficult. It would be a tragic situation. So what can we learn from what's happening in California to protect ourselves here in Texas? So, Laszlo, You know, they have regulations in California that we don't have anything like that here in Texas, where there is vegetation management requirements. Defensible space law requires property managers in high-risk areas to maintain clearance around structures to reduce fire risk. Utilities are required to manage vegetation near power lines. They have building codes where the homes have to be built out of non-combustible material. That includes the roofing, fire, ember-resistant vents, and fire-resistant siding. They have things in place already to try to prevent these fires, and it's not working.
Right. That's a good point. And those are all those things you just mentioned, you know, material requirements, soffit vent requirements, those are all adaptations. And those adaptations, as quickly as they can get through, and some, for some of them, it's very quickly because it's been a priority for California. As quickly as those can get through, they're still responding to conditions that continue to change and that will continue to change. And, you know, climate variation, climate induced weather variation is increasing, and the strength of winds and the irregularity in terms of season of winds is increasing. And adaptations like that just can't keep up. And if, as long as we, and this is to your point earlier, sort of more fundamentally, what do? If we ground ourselves in this mentality, in this cultural attitude of fighting fire, and that's our primary relationship to fire, we are going to continue to lose. We're going to continue to lose lives and homes and communities. And in the long run, we will lose a lot. We have a lot to lose. And as long as our relationship with fire is one of humans trying to dominate it and control it, we're going to continue losing.
So what we tell people, don't live there. Like after Hurricane Harvey hit Texas, we found out that there was housing developments put in places where there weren't supposed to be housing developments, and these places flooded badly. Is this basically right. The same sort of situation? People should not have been allowed to build homes to develop these areas?
Well, I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. You know, people have been living in these places in Southern California for millennia and have been experiencing problems with fire for several hundred years at this point. You know, areas around Malibu have burned multiple times. And I think it's important for us to look at our place in the ecosystem more broadly than just where do we want to put our houses? Where do we want to build infrastructure? And I think that considering that will change the calculus for some people about where they want to live. I'm not saying we should exclude, you know, home construction from, you know, entire regions just because they're fire evolved or fire adapted. I think that's kind of ridiculous. And you know, fire conscious architecture can continue to evolve, but we do have to include a little bit more weight for the role of fire in our calculations.
Well, tell me how. Give me some examples. I really want to know how that would work.
So, for example, a lot of homes in Pacific Palisades were, like you said, built with those fire adaptations in mind. However, they also had invasive and non-native eucalyptus trees, which are extremely flammable. And when you introduce fire and 100-mile-an-hour winds, then you're talking about basically a flamethrower in your front yard. And there's a limit to how fireproof we can make houses if we are, you know, building wood frame houses, which I imagine we'll continue to do. So things like what California already does, adapting to drought conditions, where certain compromises have to be made on aesthetics, on lifestyles, and that changes the calculus for people. Maybe they don't want to live somewhere where they can't have a lawn or can't have certain flammable.
What did you say? No more of these eucalyptus trees, okay? That if these things are so dangerous, don't allow them. Get rid of them.
So, sure. At the same time, you still have the problem of overstocked fuel in the chaparral and the vegetation around those areas. And so a part of it, this has to be a holistic effort. And part of what California is trying to do, like I said, with that adaptation, is reintroduce fire to a lot of those ecosystems. But it's on a scale of a goal, a statewide goal of 150,000 acres per year. This year, wildfires burned over 1 million acres in California. So if those are our adaptations, we are far behind.
Right. So I'm still trying to, get a crystallized the idea of what you're trying to sell here about, okay, we need to be different, not just adapt. We need to do something radically different, right?
Sure. So what I wanted to communicate in this article and what I would like anyone listening now to understand is that the human's place in this ecosystem, whether it's in Texas, in Southern California, in Eastern Oregon, has for a long time, for many decades, sometimes many centuries, been one of domination over the ecosystem. And until we can recognize that the role of humans in that system is critical for the health of that system, we're not going to be able to adapt to the conditions that already exist and will continue to change.
Well, that's probably not going to happen. We're going to continue being the people that we are. So, we're not going to be able to change the human species. That's just the way people are. They're going to try to dominate the environments that they're in. They're going to try to control fire because that's what we've done since we've been able to deal with fire, as a caveman. So this means we're going to be kind of locked in this cycle.
I don't think that's true. I think that in Southern California specifically, indigenous people in what is now the LA area used fire, stewarded fire, to manage that ecosystem really effectively and didn't deal with catastrophic firestorms. And that fire was a part of that ecosystem, just like humans were. And there was a relationship there that took care of the plant life, prevented fuel overstock, and replenished nutrients in the soil. So I don't think we're stuck in this relationship that we're in now. I think there's a clear timeline on when it came about, and I think that there's a way out. But I think it has to start with how we understand our place in that system.
Well, people who lost their homes in California, if they're able, they're going to rebuild. Able being how if they're going to have the – we know there's a problem with home insurance being pulled out from under these people's feet, and there's an issue with that. It's likely these places will – they will be repopulated. We're talking about a state with 40 million people in it. They will continue to live in these areas. We're not going to revert back to – times when, of the indigenous peoples, how they lived and how they dealt with things.
Right. But at the same time, we have to be able to recognize what that chaparral ecosystem, what those forest ecosystems nearby require. And a part of what they require is more fire, more good fire and less bad fire. And I don't mean good and bad fire in the sense that it is good fire is fire that humans want and bad fire is fire that humans don't want. I mean, good.
They have increased, California has increased the use of prescribed burns to reduce excessive dry fuel. They do that regularly, as I'm sure you're familiar with. There's the California Vegetation Treatment Program, streamlining, the approval of, these of trying to where the vegetation should be allowed to grow and how it should be cut back. They're doing these things.
Right. And like I said earlier, they are making these adaptations and the conditions that they're adapting to are changing constantly and changing much faster than was predicted over the last few decades out of what we would see with climate change. And so, like you said, the state of California is doing prescribed burning, doing fuel reduction, forest health programs to the tune of about 75,000 acres of so-called good fire, prescribed fire, last year. And at the same time, we have, during the season when the winds are high and everything is dry, we have over 1 million acres of wildfire burning in the state, destroying thousands of homes. And that's all, like I said, a combination of drought, climate change, weather variance, fuel overload.
What do you think is going to happen? This is, the year is just starting out this summer.
Right.
You know, we're in a drought in Texas. You know, we're wondering like what will we face when it gets hotter and drier?
Well, we know that we're going to continue seeing large wildfires across the United States, likely in places where we haven't seen them as frequently before. And at the same time, like you said earlier, an increase in moisture and an increase in irregularity of moisture, drought, increasing drought cycles, increasing moist cycles, provides flourishes and then drying out of fuel, especially fine fuels like grasses, which allow fire to travel very, very quickly. In the case of the Palisades fire, up to, you know, 60 or 80 miles an hour. And so the reality is, in terms of specific conditions, we don't know. There's a lot more variance. There are a lot more unknowns in our weather patterns, in our fire patterns. From older firefighters who I've talked to, there is a consensus that firefighting has become harder as those conditions have become more unpredictable.
Yeah, I mean, how big of a firefighting agency do you need? I mean, there's just not enough there. They didn't even have enough water. They ran out of water, even though they had filled all the tanks and they had prepared for these fires. That's the other issue. You know, there's only so much to go around. So many people, so much water, and the fire just gets bigger and bigger because of all the fuel and the winds.
Right. Right. I mean, the scale of fire that we experience now that's become normalized for people across the U.S., especially in California and other parts of the West. In 2024, we had just under 9 million acres burn in wildfires. That's just a little bit over the average since 2000, which is about 7 million. But between 1900 and 2000, the average number of acres burned every year was only 3.3 million. So we're talking about almost a threefold increase from 2024 over the 1900 to 2000 average. So as we keep scaling up resources, as we keep adding water tanks near LA, as we keep adding specialized aircraft and specialized crews and fire crews that work longer seasons and more temporary crews that work only in the peak season, we're trying to keep up with something that is growing faster than we ever thought it would.
Real quickly, we're out of time here, but real quickly, is there any place on the planet that is fighting the fire situation, dealing with fire the way that you are recommending in your story, in your article?
That's a good question. Not that I know of. I hope that there is, and I would be welcome to to hear of any places that are doing that. But at the same time, a lot of this wildfire crisis that we're experiencing is very specific to the United States and to the way that we've managed land over the last several hundred years.
Basil Quinchos is a writer. He's a firefighter. His latest article for The Nation, It's Time to Rethink Everything About How We Fight Fires. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we'll be back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Americans are becoming less healthy, and this is due to a number of factors, including our lifestyle. Americans are eating less healthy food, ultra-processed food, exercising less, smoking more. Chronic illness. Americans are developing more chronic illnesses such as diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, hypertension. Substance use. Americans are using more substances like drugs and alcohol. Social determinants of health. Americans are experiencing more stress, trauma, social isolation, and racism. And then there is the lack of access to health care in the country. And here's where that takes us. This is what we get from all that, these negative health indicators. Life expectancy in the United States has been on the decline for decades. Obesity rates among adults has risen from 30% to 42% since over the last few decades. Diabetes, more Americans are reporting type 2 diabetes diagnoses. Childhood type 2 diabetes is exploding. Depression, rates of depression are reaching new heights. Drug overdoses are increased fivefold over the last several decades. So why is this happening? Why are these negative impacts of health going on right now? What are the upstream factors that have created this unhealthy mess? Local critical care doctor Roberto Trevino Pena says we need to look at the basic forces of nature and of the brain. He has authored a new book, The Four Forces of Human Nature, A Unifying Theory. And Dr. Trevino Pena, welcome to The Source.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. Thank you for inviting me, David Martin.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to say, why I first met you and interviewed you when I was working on an audio documentary about diabetes, type 2 diabetes and childhood diabetes that we have in our society. And you have been at the forefront of trying to help children understand the impacts of unhealthy eating and unhealthy lifestyles and trying to teach them to become more health aware, more conscious, and to be more proactive in taking charge of their health, and you've received a lot of grants and a lot of accolades, and you have proven successful in, when you in these studies that you do. So, how does that factor into what we're talking about today with your book on the four forces of human nature?
Correct. So, first of all, you know that introduction was pretty dark, but it's the truth. And here's the amazing thing is that 91% of all those illnesses that you mentioned, David Martin, were something that we created ourselves, we self-inflict, we fantasize about different worries and problems. It makes our brain produce these hormones and chemistries that kind of leads us off the wrong road. But the studies that we have done, and we just published a new paper, came out 6 months ago, where we randomized. These are four-year-old children. We had 28 preschools. 14 were in our curriculums that consist of a health component, a PE component, a food service component. But the most important one is a parent component. The problem is not the children. It's the adults. And their role model that he produced for the children. So the bottom line is that we were measuring the working of their heart and their lungs, and we followed these children over 3 years. And children in our curriculums, just through lifestyle changes, education, behavioral modification, we were able to improve the function of their heart and their lungs compared to children in the control schools. So again, what's important is not to take a fatalistic approach that, you know what, I have diabetes, my parents had diabetes, I'm going to develop the disease. It doesn't work like that. 91% are problems that we produce ourselves through lifestyles, behaviors, and also our thought processes, and that's where the four forces come into play.
Mm-hmm. You are looking at it, you take a very cosmic approach to looking at these four forces. You're talking about the four forces of nature, strong force, mm-hmm. weak force, gravity, and electromagnetic force. And so I wonder, like, why go there in talking about things like our healthcare system and impacts of health?
That's a very good question, and this is the irony. Physicists know more about the universe than neuroscientists know about the brain. And just to give an example, I mean, even ourselves, we do things, and then later we're thinking, what the in the world was I thinking? And we don't understand. Sometimes we have these behaviors that we don't understand. So I went on to the physicists, the four fundamental forces of nature, and they found four forces. The strong force, which is the one that keeps the nucleus together. And then there's the weak force. That's the one that changes, that transmutates from one element to another element. And then there's a third force, the electromagnetic force, that travels in between two particles, two objects. And then the last one is the social environment, or the gravity force. So when I looked at those four forces, I went into the brain, and because the physicists couldn't put those all four together, they couldn't unify the theory. So what I did, I went into the brain, and I find that the effective force is equivalent to the strong force. The effective force, it's the first responder. That's the one that's going to keep us together. It's going to defend us. It's going to keep us out of trouble. And when it sees danger, it's the first one to respond. And that one is processed by the amygdala. The amygdala is an almond-shaped structure in the middle of the brain, and that's the one that's always on the lookout. You could be driving to work with your mind real busy. I got this deadline. My child has fever and things going in your mind. But nonetheless, you stop at a stop sign subconsciously, and you move lanes when the car's coming, or you see a red light and you stop. But that's the amygdala that's keeping you out of danger. So the amygdala, or the effective force, is equivalent to the strong force. They're both aimed at preservation or keeping us, safe. And then the next one is the weak force, and that's where one element is changed to another element. For example, chromium is changed to magnesium.
Right,
and
through
on and on and on.
Breakdown yeah. mm-hmm. of, mm-hmm. like carbon dating. That's how we tell things, how old they are, how things are broken down over time.
Exactly, yeah. So the equivalent in the brain is the cognitive force. The cognitive force is processed by the thalamus. We've always thought that it was a cerebral cortex where the intelligence is at, but really it's the thalamus. And the thalamus is right in the middle of the brain and looks like binoculars. And it's the thalamus that it grows through education. And through education, we change from one character to another character, from being, we could be homeless to be an engineer. So it's the thalamus that's the equivalent to the weak force, because they transmutate and change the character of a person. And then the third force, electromagnetic force, those are photons and radio waves going back and forth. And in the human brain, it's language. Language, it's all photons and sound waves. So when you're reading a paper, it's photons that are going back and forth between the paper and your retina. So it's equivalent. It's all related to electromagnetic forces. And then the fourth force, gravity, the aim of gravity is attraction, to keep it together. That's what clumped the universe together, just clumps things into attraction. And that is the social environment. The social environment, we have an attraction. We form clumps. We form groups, religious groups, cultural groups, professional groups. We want to belong. We want to be attracted to others. So they're very similar, and that's how those four forces, the affective, the cognitive, the communicative, and the social environment force, are equivalent to those four physics of nature forces.
So the human mind works pretty much on a subconscious level. We don't really. You say we stop at the red light, and maybe you don't. You didn't even think about it. You just did it, and then maybe you'll like, oh, I didn't realize. And you because you have been programmed in order to do things to keep yourself alive in situations like heavy traffic. How do we get kids to recognize, or all of us to recognize, that a box of donuts sitting in the middle of the office is a red light that we should not be going there?
Okay, you're talking about that the effective force, or the amygdala, that little almond shape. We have two of those on each side of the brain, and like I mentioned, all these forces are very beneficial, favorable, and they can lead us to a healthy lifestyle. But the amygdala is very tricky, because sometimes it overreacts, and when it overreacts, for example, somebody walks into the office and didn't greet you. And then the amygdala starts thinking, you know what, that person is upset with me. She doesn't like me. So when in reality, that person's husband in the morning was diagnosed with an illness. So here you go. Your amygdala takes off, and then the amygdala presses on another brain structure called the hypothalamus. And then the hypothalamus starts producing adrenaline, cortisol, corticosteroids, all these hormones and all these chemicals increases your blood pressure, increases blood sugar, causes vasoconstriction. And over time, if you continue with these faulty thinking or these fantasies, you're going to end up with chronic disease, a chronic disease that you self-inflicted. So we need to be careful when we fantasize or we imagine things, making sure
All right.
that they're relevant.
Okay, we're going to take a break here. We're going to come back talking with Dr. Roberto Trevino-Pena. He is a well-established critical care physician, doctor. He's been working on programs to help kids deal with type 2 diabetes, trying to find out what we can do, what can we correct in order to change society so that we don't have these chronic illnesses with us. His book is The Four Forces of Human Nature, A Unifying Theory. If you've got a question or a comment for him, give us a call, 833-877-8255-833-TPR-TALK. And The Source continues after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a conversation with local doctor Roberto Trevino-Pena. He has been involved in critical care treatment in San Antonio in the area for decades, and he has now written a new book, The Four Forces of Human Nature, A Unifying Theory. So, Dr. Trevino, you have an incredible story about how you became a doctor. Can you just kind of give me a bio real quickly? Because it's fascinating.
Well, my parents are immigrants from northern Mexico, and I'm the oldest of six children. And my siblings were all born at the Santa Rosa Hospital. So I was the in-betweener, meaning that I was the one that was translating between my parents and the physicians. So I was 8 years old, 6 years old. So when one of my siblings were born, I would look at these gentlemen in white coats, and I always admire them, the work they do, the good they do, and how they're able to find new science to help us treat illnesses. So even though I grew up in housing projects, the Victoria Courts, I never saw a barrier. I never saw that it could not be done. So I went on to got scholarships, went on to medical schools. And then I got two specialties in Chicago Medical School, a specialty in internal medicine, and a specialty in critical care medicine. David Martin, I was running the intensive care units of Santa Rosa Baptist and Southwest General Hospital, but I realized that the future of healthcare is not putting catheters in people's heart. It is raising healthier children. If we can start lifestyle interventions, behavior modifications at a very young age, I've noticed that children are amazing. They not only change their behaviors and they listen better, but they go up to the adults and tell, they pull out the cereal boxes from the grocery carts and tell their mom, this has a lot of sugar. So I gave up on the adults. I love them and I love my patients, but it was a struggle. But children are amazing. So again, an advice, parents, you know, always have fruits and vegetables available and be good role models to the children. Go walking 150 minutes a week. So we can solve all those problems that you mentioned at the beginning of this show, David Martin. We can solve them by, you know, inculcating healthy behaviors in children.
Well, like, you weren't born at Santa Rosa. You were born, where were you born?
But my dad was working at a ranch in Evanston, Wyoming. So I was born in Evanston, Wyoming, but it didn't go well. We were, Mexican laborers, or my parents were, and my dad was being promoted, and then for some reason, some people burned our house, and that's when my dad packed us up and brought us back to San Antonio. So So I don't remember living in Wyoming other than I was probably about 4 months old, but I grew up here in San Antonio.
Well, do you think anyone could have looked at that infant in Wyoming and then here in San Antonio at the housing projects as you grew up, and say, this child is going to grow up to be a successful doctor and a thought leader and an advocate for healthy lifestyles? I mean, there was something about you. You harnessed your mind in order to focus on elevation of yourself and your family and those around you, and so I'm thinking when you're talking about the parts of the brain, and this brain is good for, part of the brain is for identifying what's dangerous and what's good and how to have a self embetterment. This is what you did, right?
But again, the social environment, it's one of those forces that I mentioned earlier. The social environment, even though I was growing up in housing projects where there was crime and drugs, but we never thought we were poor. You know, there was a good balance. My dad was disciplined and my mom was love. So there was that fine balance. And then I went to a little Catholic school where the Hemisphere was at. With the Tower of the Americas, there was a little Catholic school called St. Michael's, the Archangel Catholic School. And the nuns really took a lot of, made sure that we learned, and provide us good education. So, that social environment was very important to go on to, get an education, medical school. So I was very fortunate to grow up in the right environment, even though the housing projects, but parents and my elementary school, that Catholic school, was providing me a good education, and that was my foundation.
So how do we get that foundation? How do we spread it? How do we get more people on a solid foundation? Let them know that it's attitude is the most important thing, and then you will gain so much.
So I'm the director of a nonprofit, the Social and Health Research Center. And the Social and Health Research Center has designed a coordinated school health program that's approved by the Texas Educational Agency. And there's a state mandate that all school districts need to implement a health curriculum that's approved by the TEA, Texas Educational Agency. Now, the importance of this curriculum, it consists, again, of a structured curriculum, and it's all bilingual. It's a health curriculum that goes from preschool all the way to eighth grade. And there's a physical education curriculum that goes again from fourth to eighth grade. And then there's the food service. Children are eating two meals in the school cafeterias. So it's a health curriculum for school cafeterias. And so to work with the school cafeteria staff. And then the fourth one is the parent component. There's newsletters that are going to the parents. They're bilingual, very easily written. So it's, we need to change the environments that influence the health of children. And the environments, most important environments, is health class, physical education, the food service department, and their home. So these curriculums are evidence-based. They're recognized by the National Institute of Health, the USDA, as evidence-based, because these curriculums has lowered glucose on children, has lowered insulin levels on children, have decreased obesity on children. So my advice is, parents, ask for these curriculums, the Bienestar Coordinated School Health Program, the Bienestar NIMA Coordinated School Health Program, and to be implemented in the schools, and we need to start early.
Mm-hmm. Well, apparently the American people are waking up to the fact that our food sources, these ultra-processed foods that we're being given, are not good for us. They want some sort of solutions, at least, better labeling on our foods that we buy at the store, stuff that's labeled healthy that's not healthy. We have, Robert Kennedy Jr. Saying make America healthy again. He doesn't have all the answers, but at least he has a message that people seem to respond to. They know something is not right.
So my simple advice, yes, ultra-processed food is one of the biggest problems that we have. And my simple advice, look at the ingredients. And if they have more than four ingredients on there, it's best to back off. And the second thing that is really important is that when we we say that we have Mexican food here in San Antonio, it's misleading. We don't need Mexican food. We eat Tex-Mex food. And Tex-Mex food, what we do is we get the worst of both cultures. We get the saturated fat from the Hispanic culture, from the Mexican culture, and we get the refined flour from the Anglo culture. So my advice, you know, go back to the roots, which is, you know, squash and black beans and corn tortillas and chicken fish and
nopalitos.
Ingredients that, you know, nopalitos. And the only persons or, you know, animals that eat nopalitos are cows and Mexicans. But nopalitos,
I've seen coyotes eat them too. So
coyotes. But yes, nopalitos are very healthy. They have all the vitamins, nutrients, antioxidants, and yes, good suggestion.
Yeah. So getting back to these basics, but also thinking about, you know, brain health, encouraging positive encouragement, telling people to think about what they think about in a positive way. Is that how we move forward? People don't need to know about the different parts of the brain, you know, the thalamus and all that.
Very important. You're saying that the brain has over 100 structures. And in this book, I explain only 4 brain structures. I narrow it down to the most important, the amygdala, the thalamus, the cerebral cortex, and the insula. And it's written at a 6th grade level, very easy to understand how these 4 brain structures really can lead us up into a more healthy lifestyle, healthier path than unknowing what, you know, how our brain works. That's a good question.
Mm-hmm. Right. So how do we popularize? You've written the book, The 4 Forces of Human Nature, a Unifying Theory. It's, like I said, it's kind of cosmic, and it sounds, you know, if I didn't know, I know you, and I know that you're a doctor, and that you know what you're talking about, you're trying to do good, but it sounds pretty, you know, out there. How do we get this into a way that people can, you know, use this and implement this?
So what I did, I have over 20 years working in the schools, writing health curriculums and doing these evidence-based curriculums. So I wanted to take that knowledge and experience of all these health books that we've written in the schools and taking it out in the schools and written it at a very simple level so that the general audience can read it. So the changes that we've seen in children where they lower their blood glucose, their insulin, improve their nutrition, their fitness level. Through this book, I'm hoping that I can get to the adults, because it is the adults where we really struggle and there's more problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Roberto Trevino Pena, thank you so much for talking to us today. His book is The 4 Forces of Human Nature, a Unifying Theory, preaching the gospel of thinking about how we're thinking about our health. I want to thank you so much for talking to us.
Bye-bye.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
Been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.